Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Solaria Report. Today we have a guest who needs no introduction here, Dr. Mark Skidmore, economics professor from Michigan State University, who once upon a time said to me, "How can I help?" And the rest is history. So Dr. Skidmore just published at missingmoney.solaria.com a new update to the missing money. And I wanted to get him back to tell us what happened, what he learned, describe the report that we have up at Missing Money, and what it means to you and me. So with no further ado, Dr. Mark Skidmore, welcome back to the Solaria Report.
I really appreciate being able to talk a little bit more about these interesting issues and times.
So tell us about the report. It started with you FOIAing the Department of Defense. Tell us how you came to submit a FOIA and what was the information you requested in the FOIA. Take us back to your prior report and how it moved up to that.
Sure. Okay. So so you and I had worked together for quite some time collecting the government reports, compiling them, organizing, all of which is on your Missing Money website. And then out of that, we did get some a fair amount of media exposure, some of which was really helpful and a lot of which wasn't very helpful. And so I think it was in early 2019, Dave Lindorf published a piece about the missing money in the nation. And in response to all of that, I had along the way asked him, make sure that you do a FOIA request for a particular set of information. And I'll talk about that in a moment, because this might give you something to triangulate with, something concrete that you can base some of your findings and conclusions, whatever they happen to be, on.
And I should just stop you for a second and mention, for those who don't know what FOIA means, it's Freedom of Information Act. So it's an act that gives a citizen authority, or someone like Dr. Skidmore, the ability to request information that should be available to citizens. Sorry, Mark, go ahead.
Sure, yeah. And so he assured me that he would do that as part of his investigation. And so he, you know, as he was interviewing top government officials at the GAO and the OI, General Accountability Office, the Office of the Inspector General, et cetera, so he was collecting different kind of interview-based information from folks, and then the article finally came out, and he told me he really had to push the editor to get the article out. He was going to take it somewhere else because he was getting frustrated. And then when it came out, I asked him, I said, you know, you didn't mention anything about a Freedom of Information Act request or obtaining any of that information that I had referred to. And I asked him, did you do a FOIA request? And he didn't answer me on that question. And I think I asked him about four times. Finally, he said, you know, I didn't have the support on the legal side that I had hoped for, and I never submitted a FOIA request. And I was very frustrated at that point. And I said, what?
I remember you as being very shocked, because you were highly confident that he had.
Yeah, I thought he had, and but he didn't. And I thought to myself, so your entire article is based only on what people told you and no actual data points or anything. And he ended up winning a national award for that piece, but he didn't submit a FOIA request. He didn't try to get any of, you know, a handle on any of the underlying information. So I would have done the FOIA request earlier, but you know, I was sort of leaning on him and what he had said. And so in July of 2019, I submitted a FOIA request, and here's what I asked for. In the Army report, which came out in 2016, for fiscal year 2015, the Army, and I think most of your subscribers are aware of this, had indicated that there were $6.5 trillion in unsupported adjustments. These are unverified transactions. And you think to yourself, how in the world could that be? The Army's budget in that year, the general fund budget, was $122 billion. How could you get $6.5 trillion, right? So in that report, there's one piece that said there are 170 adjustments that tallied to $2.1 trillion. So $2.1 trillion is not a whole lot smaller than the Canadian economy. It's huge, right? And so I asked for information about those 170 unverified transactions and what the Army said they were for and why the Office of the Inspector General considered them to be unsupported.
Now, let me mention one thing, which is the genius of your figuring out 170 transactions. Traditionally, the way the U.S. government has protected is to say, oh, it's very complicated. There are millions of transactions, da-da-da-da-da. The beauty of this one, because they had affirmed in their own documentation that it was only, quote-unquote, 170 transactions, the excuse that they can't find it or produce it because it's an overwhelming amount of stuff kind of goes away.
Yeah.
How hard can it be to do 170, to provide the evidence on 170 transactions?
I mean, if I were producing a report like that and it were of these magnitudes, I would feel compelled to provide some more information. The existing reports are very cursory. You know, it's like, oh, well, there's a, you know, 2 trillion here, a trillion there, tallying to 6.5 trillion. It's like, what? You know, that's a third of the GDP of the entire United States coming from a budget of 122 billion. It's like fingers on a chalkboard and no questions are being asked. And so I submitted that request and it took them months. It went around to the OIG, to the Indianapolis office, down to the Army and down in Arkansas. And I'll allow you to tell the story about the Arkansas.
So it went to Alabama.
Oh, Alabama, yeah.
It went to Alabama and it was, let me just go back and look at it. Say all the documents that are involved in this are listed on your report at missingmoney.salary.com. And So during the early 2000s, I was working with someone who ran a website for a former intelligence officer who claimed to be good at, or, you know, his beat was financial fraud. And the guy was really, I mean, one thing, I spent a lot of time talking to him about financial fraud, and I will say this, you know, whoever he was and wherever he came from, he did really know a lot about financial fraud. Anyway, but they used to publish articles on Redstone Arsenal and all the illegal arms sales going out the back door of Redstone Arsenal in Alabama. And I would read these things and I would never know what to think. And one day I was up at the webmaster's home. I was on my way out to Kalispell, Montana, and this guy had a place in Montana. So he said, wait a minute, I'm putting up an article. Come look at my web stats. And he had real-time live. You could see who's coming into the website. And that was the day when you could still see the, you know, specific ISP, so you could identify exactly who was coming in. So this happened several times when I was there. He would put up an article, and the next thing you know, it was Goldman Sachs and Brothers. You know, it's all the big Wall Street firms coming in to figure out, you know, who's getting what money. I figured they probably wanted to make cold calls. And, you know, I started to realize, oh, all this funny business may be going on at Redstone Arsenal. Now, if you look at what the different operations traditionally have been at Redstone Arsenal, the idea that they would be dealing with this FOIA, I just started laughing. I couldn't believe, I thought, you know, the Redstone is probably being punished and it's their job to come up with some, you know, some phony explanation of what this all is. Anyway, so it was just very amusing to me that it got there.
Well, so it went to the Redstone Arsenal and then back to the OIG. And finally, after several months, early in 2020, I got a response with a listing of, in a PDF document of 170 adjustments with the amounts for each adjustment and a brief explanation of why it was considered unsupported. Now the explanations aren't very detailed or in depth, and in fact a lot of them were just cut off so you can't really see exactly what is going on. And so I organize them, put them into a spreadsheet, and then just in the report that you see on the Solari website, you can see the top 10 adjustments, some of which are in the trillion or billions of dollars. And I'll talk about that in just a minute. But the descriptions are sort of vague, you know. And so you could think of them as plugs. This is the term that Dave Lindorf used in his article that appeared in The Nation. There's a $116 billion adjustment that indicates it was done to bring balances into agreement. There's an $88 billion adjustment that says to clear abnormal balances. An $86 billion adjustment indicates errors and reasonableness checks. There's one adjustment for $163 billion that indicates that there was the customer was unable to provide, and then the explanation is cut off, so you can't really see what the explanation is. So, you know, so if these were in the millions of dollars, that would be a substantial amount just to overlook, but you know, in the context of an Army budget of just $122 billion, how can you get a $163 billion adjustment, unsupported, an unverified transaction, and the explanation is the customer is unable to provide some sort of information?
Right, so, and we have no access to banking data. That would tell us how much of the 120, if the Army had a $122 billion budget year, how much money flowed out of those accounts and how does it compare to some of these adjustments? We have no access such as that. And of course, the push to audit the Fed might give us some of the access, but it hasn't happened.
Right. So the bottom line is the unverified transactions are enormous, and the descriptions, if they were smaller amounts, might seem reasonable, but when it's $163 billion for one transaction and it just says the customer was unable to provide information, you have to ask yourself, well, what in the world can that be? And this is where, you know, under a typical circumstance, I think an auditor would go start tracking things down. There would be an inquiry, and he would walk all the way through to identify what exactly happened and why.
Right.
And to my knowledge, that doesn't happen. It just is reported, and then you're done.
Well, but here's what's interesting. What has been happening for over 20 years now is that the explanation from the Department of Defense. So if you look at all the laws related to financial management and financial disclosure, we know they have systematically broken those laws steadily for 20 right. years. And if you look at their explanation of these 170 financial transactions, it doesn't make any sense. So you have somebody who's openly and blatantly broken the law for 20 years, who will not give a responsive document that shows what they're really doing with the money, and yet they continue to be treated by the corporate media as though their word means something. I mean, if the Department of Defense said to me something about their financial management, you know, to me, it wouldn't be meaningful because this is not a source that's credible.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if a publicly traded company didn't produce audited financial statements as required by law, they'd be thrown off the exchange. So this is somebody who for 20 years has not been thrown off the equivalent of this exchange, the largest issuer of securities in the world. And yet we continue to treat them. And we know that when S&P had the courage to downgrade their bond credit, they basically attacked them and almost destroyed the company.
Yeah.
So the credit agencies aren't allowed to comment. The primary dealers are deeply compromised. Their banks, you know, are not only deeply compromised, but arguably running the show. And so to this day, I don't understand why a word they say is treated as a logical explanation by anybody.
I would agree. And then with Standard 56, the Federal Accounting Standards Advisory Board Standard 56, with the implementation of that, we really can't say anything about what the federal government finances are doing. They themselves have told us that they can modify the financial statements in order to conceal information. And, you know, if there were some parameters, you know, I've read Standard 56 a number of times now, and as far as I can tell, there are no parameters around the degree to which these financial statements can be modified for the public viewing. And so that
right, and we can't know who's doing it and by what process.
Yeah.
So it's not just that we, you know, they can basically do whatever they want. We don't know who's doing it and what the process is.
It's not clear who's making that decision. I talked with, I happened to see Mr. Showalter, who was the chair of the Federal Accounting Standards Advisory Board at the time this was going through. And he, you know, he looked at me and said, well, you know, this is not an uncommon thing in governments for to conceal certain types of information. but I said, but the thing is there, you know, we do have a black budget, number one, already.
Right.
So you know, there's some things we just can't see. And number two, that, you know, there, and I pushed him a little bit on this. I said, there's no constraint on how much these books can be modified. It applies to any public entity or agency. It can, you know, there's no parameters around how much these things can be modified. So the bottom line is that we just can't say anything about the financial statements that are coming out since this Standard 56 was implemented. And, you know, so if you were sort of drinking the Kool-Aid, you could say, well, it's only for, you know, minor modifications to conceal sensitive information. If you're not drinking the Kool-Aid, you're saying, whoa, this opens the door for all kinds of things to be hidden, and we have no idea.
So I remember, you know, when I used to try and warn people about the missing money, what I would hear is, you know, I'm sure it's just an accounting error. They couldn't possibly, you know, with $122 billion budget for the Army, or now a $738 billion for the DOD, they couldn't steal many multiples of their budget. And what I would say is, yes, they can with securities fraud, because I was watching tremendous securities fraud in the mortgage markets. And so I also, there were hints that it might be going on the Treasury market, but I didn't really dig into the Treasury market. And then when the bailouts happened, I said, see, I told you, you know, we just cleaned up, you know, 24 to 29 trillion of securities fraud. That can finance a lot. Anyway, so one way you could try and estimate the, you know, the envelope, the size of the funny business is to dig in and see how much money is rolling around in the Treasury market and if it's greater than the outstanding official amount of debt. So I believe I've seen lots of indications to indicate that the outstanding debt is much greater than what is officially listed on the book. So the second part of your report, in fact, dives into just that, and it's unbelievably fascinating. So why don't you tell us what it is and why you decided to take a look?
Sure. I think this is actually the most more interesting part of the report, is that what's happening, what appears to be happening in the Treasury market. And we framed it as asking questions, doing an evaluation, asking questions, inviting others to chime in and offer their thoughts. You know, as you know, Catherine, when you get some exposure in the public, there are a number of people who will contact you and ask questions or send a note. And in this particular case, there's a gentleman, a lawyer here in Michigan, whose name is Tom Stannis, sent me a note and said, you know, I've been watching your discussions with Catherine Austin Fitz about the money, and have you ever looked at the Treasury markets? And he pointed to information on the Treasury website that that offer detailed transaction, daily, monthly, and annual transactions of the Treasury on the issuance of debt and also on redemptions. So in 2019, there were about $91 trillion in debt issuance and $90 trillion in redemptions. And in that year, there was about $22 trillion in total debt. And so the reason why you might have more issuance in a year than the total debt is because some of that debt comes to term. And I'm going to explain that in a minute. So from year over year, between 18 and 19, you had about $1 trillion of new debt issuance. This is your deficit spending that you had in that year. So that's roughly, I would imagine, the difference between the total issuance and the redemptions, 91 trillion in issuance and 90 in redemptions. But the debt for the government comes in different term lengths, the lengths of a bond. So, you know, a long-term bond might be a 30-year length. So in any given year of the total debt in that 30-year term, about 3.3% would require turnover, right? So when that debt comes due, you would reissue, right? Because you're not paying off the debt. You're always adding to it. At least in modern times, we've always added to it. So whenever debt comes due, you have to reissue it, right? So if a 30-year bond comes due, you reissue. But in any given year, only 3.3% would require reissuance, right? Because 1 over 30 is 3.3%. However, there is a lot of short-term debt. The shortest term is a four-week bill, and that would require in a year a turnover of 13 times, right? Because there are 13 four-week sessions across 52 weeks of a year. So in order to maintain in that debt, you'd have to turn it over 13 times. You issue a four-week a debt instrument. It comes due in 4 weeks, you reissue it, and you do that every 4 weeks. So over the course of a year, you'd have to reissue it 13 times. So you could potentially get a lot of debt issuance over the course of the year. So to answer the question of how much debt reissuance is required to sustain a $22 trillion debt, you'd have to sort of figure out how much debt is in each specific debt category by term length. And so in the report, we summarize that information so that you can see of the $22 trillion, how much is in the 4 week, the 8 week, the 13th, the 26 week, the 52 week, the 1, 2, and so on, 5 year, 10 year, 30 year notes. So you can kind of see how much turnover would be required for each component of the debt. And what's interesting is, and I didn't know what this would look like until you look, went through the analysis, but for that $22 trillion, it looks like we only needed about $16 trillion of reissuance to sustain that debt. And yet we have $90 trillion and reissuance.
Right.
And so we've posed this as a question.
Which suggests either that debt is much shorter in maturity than we thought, or there's a lot more debt floating around.
Yeah. And so if you just look at the math, it's really hard to see that we've missed anything in terms of, are we overlooking some debt that's very short term in nature and require a lot of turnover and thus trillions of dollars of reissuance? It doesn't appear that way. You only have in that shorter term just a few trillion in less than a year. So it doesn't require that much turnover as far as we can tell with the data that we have. And we've accounted for all of the $22 trillion debt at the end of the fiscal year in 2019. So one conclusion you could draw, if our analysis is right and we haven't missed anything, is that there's far more dead out there than what is officially recorded.
And what's interesting, if you provided a graph that showed the total issues versus redemptions, mm-hmm. and public debt in your report, and what you see is the spread between what's supposed to be outstanding and what's rolling around is getting steadily wider from 2000 on. And that's the period, if you look at the full $21 trillion, you know, about $17 and $18 trillion of that happened after 2000 when your graph starts. So it would make sense if you're issuing securities secretly and rolling them around, they're off books. This is exactly the pattern that you would expect to see.
You know, and we can't be definitive yet,
right.
but it's interesting, you know, the largest recording of unsupported adjustments occurred in 2015-16 with the Army with $6.5 trillion. And in that year, the amount of total debt issuance increased dramatically.
Right.
More than the general increase over time. So that's a, you know, it's not necessarily causal, but there is an interesting correlation there. So I don't know the answer, but that ratio between the total debt and the total number of redemptions required in turnover, you know, over time, that gap is growing over this entire period. So it looks like, and so then the question you could ask yourself is, well, maybe we're just issuing a lot more short-term debt. And the answer is early on, that is partially true because, and I thank Rob Kirby for sharing this information, but for a while, the federal government stopped issuing 30-year bonds. And so the average term length did decrease for several years. And then in 2006 or 7, I think, they started issuing 30-year bonds again. And so the average term length isn't really getting shorter and thus requiring more, you know, a higher turnover and greater redemption. So that's not explaining it. So if we haven't missed anything and that debt composition is fairly stable, doesn't change a lot from year to year or month to month, it looks like the total redemption rate could support over $120 trillion in total debt.
Right.
And so we've put that out there in this report and in the context of asking the question, what are we missing? Is this right? Because if it is, it suggests that the total redemption and reissuance activity is supporting far more than the $22 trillion of acknowledged debt.
So I want to bring this back to what does it mean to you and me? There are two. I was just reviewing what we're going to talk about in Money and Markets for the June 11th Money and Markets commentary. And the two top stories for the week are, one, the financing of the operations we're watching all across America. And I don't know if you remember this, when Matt Taibbi decided he would write an article about FASB 56, I got frustrated and sent him a message that said, what is it about secret money for secret armies you don't understand? And of course, Matt Taibbi does understand secret money for secret armies. But I was, if you look at what is now possible with FASB 56 and the absence of any audited financial statements or financial accountability, what it does is it puts a group of people who are secret from us in a position to be able to access a near infinite amount of money to do whatever they want.
And I'm a really, you know, part of the mission that I have in my role at the university. I hold an endowed chair in government finance and policy. And one of the foundations is transparency. If you don't have transparency, lots of things can happen. Lots of things can happen that aren't good. And so, you know, one of the things I appreciate about your work, Catherine, and the opportunity to work with you on this is that
we're trying to shed some light and increase that transparency, because if we can know something more about this, then we have a great amount of power to influence and say something about how this is happening, what is happening. But if we don't know, we just, you know, we can just dismiss it, and we're missing out and losing out on a whole lot in terms of what our country is founded on.
Well, you know, one of my pipe dreams, and I use pipe dream because my attorney used to always say that's a pipe dream, was that, you know, by county or by some kind of local area, but under state legislator protection, we come together and pay our federal taxes into an escrow under court control, state court control, and basically say, you know, the U.S. government has run away financially. They're, you know, this is equivalent of a financial citizen's arrest. So we're going to escrow our taxes, send them a check for the military. And by the military, I mean the $738 billion of the military on budget expense, not the average $1 trillion of undocumentable adjustments. So we'll send them the
recognized,
you know, a portion
amount,
for the military and a portion for the debt to pay the interest on the debt. But, you know, the rest of the money we'll keep here. Thank you very much. And re-engineer the local expenditures, because we have an obligation as citizens to assert lawful management of this money. And if you're going to run a criminal enterprise, you know, then we have an obligation as citizens to re-engineer the money. Now, that still leaves open the question of who gets to control the treasury and issue more treasury bonds. So it's not a complete solution. But I think ultimately, whenever anybody asks me what the solution is, you've got to deal with the money, and you've got to deal with it one county and one family at a time, because I think the undocumentable adjustments are up, you know, as of 2015, we're up to $65,000 per family, or I'm sorry, 65,000 per person. So for a family of four, it's $250,000.
I have to do the numbers again, but that sounds right to me. I've done that calculation before as well. I understand why your lawyer says that's a pipe dream, because it is really difficult to imagine how 3,000 plus counties would organize themselves and autonomously decide to create an escrow and say we're gonna put a watch on this. And I'm not sure what the answer is, but in my mind, If number the first step is to help people understand,
right,
and if they understand, then they can protest,
right.
But if they don't understand, if they don't know, or they just think, oh, that's just, you know, a crazy thing, you know, these are all coming from official government reports, and we're just asking what would be reasonable questions. And not and getting, you know, stymied along the way and not having the kind of information you would need to really do an evaluation. And of course, you know, the story about, you know, the media taking this and spinning it one way or another rather than actually going in and trying to find the hard data, it's very frustrating.
So I see the average American taxpayer or citizen as being seriously financially drained by this. So I'll use an example closer to home. Through my real estate taxes, I'm paying for the school, but the school is getting their vaccine policies and their curriculum from Bill Gates, and I have no say. So, you know, we're running into this taxation with no representation process.
Well, and then just the opportunity cost. You think about, I know here in Michigan, our roads are in really bad shape. You know, our infrastructure is old.
Mm-hmm.
And if we had some transparency about how much money was being spent and where it was going and to what purpose, you might reprioritize and do things that help improve the productivity of the country. And You know, I've been to other countries, and I know that the infrastructure, you know, is really in need of repair.
Right.
Or as you've mentioned many times, we, you know, we've, in order to fund all of this, we've steadily reduced, you know, suppressed interest rates, falling. And that's a big reason that the pension funds are struggling so much. You know, you have a projected rate of return that you need in order to make good on your promises. And, you know, the pension funds systematically miss those targets. And so if you adjust your expected rate of return downward, then you have to ask more from taxpayers to fund it. And of course, they're already pressed. You know, so the debt cycle and the lowering of the interest rates pushes, you know, makes, exasperates the pension
right.
problem. And so, you know, all of these things are having an impact.
So let me ask you a question. When I finished the litigation, I owed Citibank $14,000. I'd had a credit card when the litigation started with Citibank that was $14,000. And then, of course, when everything got frozen, I couldn't pay. So I wrote Citibank a letter. And at that point, the undocumentable adjustments were up to $14,000 per person. So I wrote Citibank a letter and said, you know, I hereby affirm that I owe you $14,000. And here's my calculation as to why you owe me $14,000. Because it was Citibank, JP Morgan Chase, and the New York Fed member banks that affected these transactions. So I'm asserting a common law right of offset. And if you have the problem with that, please contact my lawyer here. And I sent it off. And I never heard a word from Citibank, and no debt collector, anybody else, ever tried to collect the $14,000, which I thought was very
That's
interesting.
Amazing.
Now, let me turn to Flint, Michigan. Why is it not possible? You know me, I never give up with my pipe dreams. Why is it not possible for everybody in Flint, Michigan, who owes any one of the New York Fed member banks any money, to say, you know something, we're going to assert a common law right of offset. You owe us $65,000 per person, and instead we're going to put that money into a fund to fix our water system.
You know, I'm a little bit outside my wheelhouse in trying to respond to that because I just don't know the legal ramifications of stepping in that direction. You have a particular case
right, so,
for you, Catherine, in which it worked, and you had
right.
the evidence. And so I guess I can't really answer that question.
Right.
Not knowing the legal ramifications, you know.
Well, I still, you know, every time I talk about these things, I always call for lawyers. If you're a lawyer and you want to help me figure out how to do it, I think the time is coming when we might be able to do something, but it's a conversation for another day. Okay, so I just want you to take a minute, because I find it to be absolutely fascinating, the journey that you've been on since you started looking into the missing money. And so now that we have you, could you just say a few minutes, give us a few minutes on what the latest round of that journey has been for you personally?
Maybe I'll back up to 10 years ago because I think, as I talk to people who, I guess you could say, you know, stopped drinking the Kool-Aid, came out of the matrix, however you want to describe it, they do it in relation to something they know really, really well. You know, if it's in the medical field, they see something happening and they realize, oh my God, you know, this is not what it seems to be. There's something more here. Or in my case, you know, or you could do it in law. In my case, I was, you know, a PhD economist, and I was blindsided by what happened during the financial crisis. The week before, you interviewed John Titus, and he kind of described a similar experience.
He did. He really had a very similar experience.
You know, and he realized, oh, the rule of law does not exist. And that was a wake up call,
mm-hmm.
and that is what happened to me. I thought, I cannot believe what is happening. My models, my frameworks, all that I had learned doesn't help me understand what is going on in, you know, in the midst of that financial crisis and how they dealt with it and the choices that were made and the trillions of dollars that were given away and to only certain groups of people. And so that was a, you know, really kind of a point of personal crisis, right? You're like, wow, I'm supposed to be a knowledgeable person. And yet I can't use my knowledge to help me understand what was going on. And so that was the wake up call. And I started tracking and finding and realizing if that is an arena in which I'm supposed to know something and I'm missing a whole lot, what else do I have wrong? And so then you start realizing, oh, well, the media doesn't really give you what you need, right? And so then you have to try to find other sources of information that have integrity and competence, and that's a journey. How do you go about doing that? So, you know, when I stepped into this to look at the missing money, I had listened to you, Catherine, a number of times, and so I decided to reach out and say, hey, why don't I ask a couple of graduate students just to do a systematic search through government websites looking for similar reports and see what we can tally up. And I think at that point you had, referred to documents that were maybe up to about 12 trillion with right. The Army report.
Right.
And so we were able to compile and organize documents that showed that $21 trillion, you know, the same excuses used over and over and over again.
I'll never forget. I think your first draft of the first report, you I think it was $17 trillion. And then you'd kept calling me and saying, oh my God, we found another trillion. Oh my God, we found another trillion.
And the hard part, I think, for people in general is to... You know, it's the same, you know, it's the question I had when we were doing this. It's like, why are we finding these reports? If we're so far off, wouldn't it be hiding? And same thing with this treasury, you know, we're finding, official reports that indicate that $91 trillion of issuance is supporting $22 trillion in debt. Well, why? What's going on? And so somehow we're finding information that appeared to be a discrepancy with, what you would call official reality. And, you know, and so what does it mean? And how do you get to the bottom of it? And so it's been a journey for me in all of these arenas to just keep an open mind.
I'll never forget.
To ask questions.
I'll never forget. I think it was 2016. I went to a meeting in Australia, and there was a very prominent Chinese economist there who'd had a very high official role at the time of bailouts. And I realized just from listening to his speech and talking to him that before the financial crisis hit, they knew about the fraud in the mortgage market. And I thought, okay. That means the leadership at the top is playing a game together, you know, and they know.
Yeah. It perhaps, you know, it's hard for me to say because I only get, you know, bits and pieces and glimpses. When you had a website regarding the Redstone Arsenal, it made me think of something. And again, I don't know if this is, you know, causal or not, but we published the report on this update on your Solari. And last week, I get a LinkedIn updates. You know, I have a LinkedIn uh-huh. account, and so people can find you and look you up. And so for some reason, somebody from Goldman Sachs looked me up. That doesn't happen normally for an academic with my field of expertise. So it makes me wonder if they were looking at your report, you know, the report on your website, and or not. I don't know, but that's an it's an interesting thing that happens. You know,
well, so during, that's an interesting thing. During the bailouts, and this went on for over a year, the number one question we would ask every morning, that was when you could still track it, it was on your website, was would the number one user of our website be the Fed, the New York Fed, Fannie Mae, or Goldman Sachs? And the only time it wouldn't be one of those three players who are usually, you know, one, two, three, four, they just change positions each, was when a firm would go down, that firm would be number one on our website for a couple of weeks, Bear Stearns and Lehman being the two. And then AIG.
So they would go to your website.
They used to go tremendously. Now, you know, everybody comes in through a ISP generic, so you can't see the firms the way you used to be able to. But we used to get enormous traffic, and I'm sure they've read and digested all of the missing money website.
Yeah. So that's my... You know, that's been sort of my journey, and I'm sure a lot of your subscribers have had similar experiences where they just saw a glitch. It didn't make sense in an arena where they're supposed to have a high level of knowledge, and they realize that they're missing something. And that gives you just enough of a crack to look behind, you know, look behind the curtain and then begin to ask questions. And that's what I view doing here is, you know, with the Treasury stuff, there appears to be a discrepancy, and we're using all of the information available to us from official sources, and we're finding something that seems off, and we're asking questions, and that is a useful thing to do.
So I want to mention the second story I was going to mention in Money and Markets this week is Stephen Roche, who is the author of Unbalanced, which I think is one of the best books on the U.S.-China relationship, and has been on the Salieri. He came on the Salieri Report when he published it. Just published an article in Bloomberg, an opinion piece, saying that the U.S. dollar is going to lose its reserve currency status. He's declaring the beginning of the end, and and I think that your report here is very important, because if you look at whatever's going on in the Treasury market, and then if you look at whatever is going on in the Fed balance sheet, you know, John Titus was just on the Salieri Report, and hopefully you're going to be meeting with him soon. And, you know, but if you look at the ballooning of the Fed balance sheet, and if you look at the ballooning of what's rolling over in the Treasury market, the question is, And you know, Rob Kirby always shows the ballooning of the money supply, and the debt spiral up. The question is, how much more of these of the bubble that is occurring in the Treasury market and in the money supply, how long can that go on? And I don't know the answer. I don't think anybody does, but that is the question, because at some point it's possible the world could walk away.
Yeah, I have wondered that myself. And this is, you know, we're looking at data that are reported, and and they've already told us that they're not going to share the true data with us necessarily. So we don't really know the extent. You know, I think that's one of the points that Rob Kirby makes. It's like, wow, there's a lot more, you know, that money supply increase is probably much greater than is officially reported, and is supported by some of the work that we've done. So is it, you know, how long can it last? And I think we all know that what is happening is completely unsustainable and that it can't continue.
And then the unsustainability on the financial side is reflected in the unsustainability in the cultural behavior and the on the human and day-to-day side.
I agree.
Right. Well, Dr. Mark Skidmore, I can't say that it's always a pleasure to discuss these topics, but it's always a pleasure to talk with you. I would love to see response from people in the Treasury market. So let me just ask the subscribers, if you know anybody who's active in the Treasury market or in managing money in the fixed income area, you know, please send them a link to this report. It's at Missing Money. Or you can, if you just go on the homepage, you can pick it up as a special report. Just put in Missing Money, you can pick it up. Send it to them and ask them to give us feedback on what they know, because this is like a jigsaw puzzle. And the more pieces, I think that Mark gets, the, you know, more pieces he can put together. So we're really hoping that this circulates much more broadly. So I would encourage you to pass it around to anybody you know who is interested in the treasury security and the fixed income markets. Any other thoughts, Mark, before we go?
I really appreciate all the work that you've done, Catherine, and I'm glad to make a contribution. And we are experiencing extraordinary times with, you know, the riots and the civil unrest, the Fed coming out and saying we will buy anything and every kind of debt in order to sustain and hold the markets up. We have all that money flowing into the stock market. We have federal deficits that will approach $4 trillion this year. And we have a GDP that's anticipated to have declined by 50%. So there's so much swirl happening. And all of that is good for us to be aware of and keep track of. But I think the key message is that what sustains the crazies is this hidden financing.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
So we will come back to power and control. Who has a power? Who has a control? Can we increase that transparency and say, no, we're not going to go there. We need something different. I think that that's important for us all to keep our minds on, because there's so many things out there that are important to be watching, but maybe it's kind of a distraction in a way.
If you look at all the operations that are going on across America, the covert operations, you know, every time I look at those, I think that's what happens when you let things like FASB 56 happen. So
yeah,
I keep hearing in my mind your daughter's song. Remember, we were going to get the conversation into the campaign.
What campaign?
Okay, well, Dr. Mark Skidmore, thank you so much for joining us on the Solaria Report. You have a wonderful day.
Thanks, Catherine. You too.